Hi, CCC family. This is Pastor Mike Gett. Today is September 13th, and we're going to be studying Job 18 through 21, chapters 18 to 21. Now, at this point in the book, they've just finished the second cycle of speeches and responses from Job and his friends. There's going to be one more of these cycles of exchanges before there are two more voices heard from in the book. But basically, at this point in the book, here's what we know. Deeply rooted assumptions are very difficult to deal with, and that's why nothing that Job can say or do is going to shake the belief of his three friends that he is suffering because he has sinned greatly against the Lord. To them, there can be no other possible explanation for the devastation that they see. God's completely just. He punishes evil and he rewards good. Now Job is being punished, or at least how else could you describe what they saw? Therefore, Job must be, in their mind's eye, a very evil man. It's just that simple. It's a no-brainer for them. And the one thing that Eliphaz and company can think of is to try and convince Job that that's what's going on, convince him to confess so he can be forgiven, and then be relieved of this oppression. These guys really do want to help. They're his friends. But when we start with a wrong assumption, we can sometimes keep ourselves from ever seeing what's really going on. And that's the case here with his three friends. Bildad says, Job, when are you going to stop these endless speeches and deal with the facts that are as obvious as the nose on your face? And Job responds, Bildad, when will you please stop talking long enough to listen to what I'm saying? I mean, they got this four-way nonsense conversation going on. And it's going nowhere. And they're operating on completely different wavelengths, totally different channels. There's no connecting. Now, when people are hurting as badly as Job is hurting, they do not need answers. Sometimes they don't even want answers. They need, and what they really want, is reassurance. They need to know that somebody, especially God, really cares. And that's what Job wasn't feeling here. His comforters had become his accusers. And as far as he could tell, God was his attacker. His brothers were alienated. They stayed away. His relatives left him. His friends were gone. His guests, you know, the people that he frequently entertained, they forgot all about him. His servants didn't want to know him. They wouldn't even respond to him if he begged, it says. Even his own wife was disgusted with him. Wow. My breath is offensive to my own wife, he says. Even children mocked and laughed at him. No one even tried to comfort him. Not one person. And that's all Job was looking for, was a comforter. But nobody would fill the position. And so Job turns back to his faith. The only thing he has left. And though appearances are all to the contrary, he decides to trust God. And he utters the words which have become the most famous words of this book, which are, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end, he's going to stand upon the earth, and after my skin's been destroyed, yet in my flesh, I shall see God. I myself will see him with my own eye, and not another. How my heart yearns within me, he says. You see, he's absolutely certain that it ends well for him. Now, this is the most blatant affirmation in the book of Job of his belief in life after death and the immortality of the soul. And it is a brilliant example of faith in action. With all the evidence to the contrary, Job chooses. He elects to believe and place his faith in God despite the apparent injustice of his current position. Now, Zophar's second speech sounds nauseatingly familiar to Job. It does to me too. God will punish the wicked. Though they prosper for a season, their end is always bad, as God vents his burning anger against them. And he says, Job, this is what's happening to you. Now, once again, if we're going to read Zophar's speech as a standalone piece of literature, we would find very little to quarrel with, as long as it was understood that while the wrath of God is sometimes delayed with reference to the wicked even until after they have died, because there are rich, wicked men who die peacefully in their beds, Job is right in observing that in chapter 2, but even they are under the wrath of God, and they will also feel the white-hot heat of his anger. Zophar's theology is fine. It's his application that's flawed, and he uses truth as a battering ram to further demoralize his afflicted companion. Now, in some of his previous responses to Job, or Job's responses, he was speaking to God as much as he was to his accusers, okay? But now Job's very angry. His tone is sharp, and he responds very pointedly to Zophar. So sharply, in fact, that Zophar will take no part in all of the third set of dialogues. He just got nothing left to say. I wish I had that skill. Now, Zophar has suggested that all of Job's troubles were of his own fault, because he'd earned God's wrath through a whole series of hidden, secret sin. He begs again for a fair hearing, which Zophar has, until this point, been unwilling to give him. Job's observations from the ash heap are pretty well diametrically opposed to those of Bildad and Zophar. You know, they see wicked people who have been brought low by the judgment of the Lord, but for every case that they can cite and put forward, Job says he can think of several in which the wicked came out smelling like a rose. Their children are established around them while they grow old and increase in power. Their homes are safe. They're free from fear. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows do not miscarry. They send their children forth as a flock. They sing and they dance to the music of the tambourine and the harp, and they make merry to the sound of the flute. They spend their years in prosperity, and they go down to the grave in peace. Bildad had said that the lamp of the wicked snuffed out. But in truth, asked Job, how often does that really happen? Now, without the clear teaching of the New Testament that is perhaps best summarized by the words of the writer of the book of Hebrews in chapter 9, verse 27, here it says, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after that, judgment. Now, it is hard to prove, minus that knowledge, that God always punishes the wicked and always blesses the righteous. And from the perspective of this life only, minus the New Testament, the justice of God may legitimately be questioned, and the pious arguments of Bildad and Zophar, they can sound pretty hollow. Now, in closing, I want to share with you two things. Number one, unlike Job and his friends, we have the clear, explicit teaching of the New Testament. What he could only see dimly and grasp by faith, we can see much more clearly. Though we too must exercise faith to believe the New Testament about the great day of judgment when those who have rejected the revelation of God and stored up for themselves a treasure of wrath will stand before the judgment seat of Christ and be cast into the lake of everlasting fire, we have a great deal more revelation to go on. And we got a lot more teaching that we can rely upon. And number two is this. When we're confronted with the apparent free pass that some evil people seem to enjoy, we can be very certain that whether in this life or the next, justice will be done. Let's just remember this, though. And this is important for me as well for you. Apart from the grace of God in providing the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, we would share in their very same fate.